We are honoured to introduce our guest today, Brother Abdullah Al-Dawsi, who is an Islamic activist thinker and an inspirational thinker and an inspirational speaker. I will allow him to introduce himself, but the topic today is about gender equality and whether Islam promotes gender equality. The talk will be approximately 45 minutes long, followed by a Q&A session, God willing. Enjoy the talk.
Short sweet. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين الصلاة والسلام على نبينا الكريم محمد وعلى آله الطيبين وصحبه الصالحين I preach all the Islamic greetings of peace Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh May the peace and blessings of God be upon you all Now the question is Does Islam promote gender equality? And it's a question which has received quite a lot of attention, quite a lot of interest, and many people. So many people are fascinated to see about whether this is the case. Is there something in Islam which is contrary to gender equality, or does Islam actually promote it and conducive to it? But I want to ask a more fundamental question, because a lot of the times the agenda that is set for us is set by something external to us, by society, by pundits, by media, by politicians. But we have to ask a more fundamental question. Why equality? And not just about gender, but just equality full stop, the actual concept. Why equality? Why are we equal, or how do you justify equality? Let's look at the current pervading political, philosophical justifications for it. So they say we're equal, but on which basis do you justify human equality? It used to be based on the idea of natural rights, that we all, nature ordains that we are equal. Does nature ordain that we're equal? Does nature care about equality? If you look at nature, stronger animals, stronger beasts, stronger creatures devour or show no little sympathy for lesser or weaker beasts if their interests are challenged. We see this in monkeys, we see this in apes, we see this in ants, we see this in almost every animal species there is. Nature doesn't seem to care about equality. If you are stronger, more intelligent, more resistant to disease, more resistant to things like cancer, or you age better, you have a natural advantage, you will survive longer, you will have your progeny will be most likely to be more successful, and you'll have more of progeny than any rival. So nature doesn't really care about equality. What other basis can then we derive equality from? Let's say, well, maybe we're just equal in sharing an attribute of being human. But this is an arbitrary attribute, because I could say that we're all equal to the chairs we sit on because we share the common attribute of matter, and the chair has the same attribute, even organic matter as well. It's made from wood, right? So even organic matter. So why this particular attribute we're singling out and saying we're equal in sharing an attribute, and the attribute itself isn't equal? How would you define even humans? Would be a good discussion. Would you say that a human being is someone that has intelligence? What if there's a people who don't have intelligence? Are they not equal then? Are not deserving of your respect? Some people say that, some liberal philosophers will say that, as a matter of dogma or blind faith, that there is something intrinsic in us which is human, deserves equal respect, and is inalienable, cannot be taken away from us regardless. And I say, okay, so let's take one particular right they say we all equally have access to, which is the right to freedom. Right, the right not to be stuck in a cage, in essence. Let's take that example. So, and we have this right, why? Because we're human. That's how the argument goes. So then, why are there criminals in prison? Are they not human? Have they ceased being human beings? And if their right to freedom is connected to just them being humans, and they haven't ceased to be human, then why lock them in cages and prisons? Surely then it would contradict their right to equality, equal treatment to humans who are not locked in cages. So this is the current dilemma of secular, mostly Western philosophies to produce any justification for the concept of equality. And many philosophers have noticed this. Louis Poyman, who wrote Are Humans Equal? A Critique of Contemporary Egalitarianism. He said, if we are to accept the empirical reality of people and their differences, there should be a presumption of inequality rather than the presumption of equality upon which so many political philosophers depend. Hunter Baker, a political scientist, he said, if we are equal, it is almost surely in the sense that we are equal before God, because we are equal in virtually no other way. So there is no other justification from a secular or a materialistic basis to say that we're equal. The Greeks had the concept of isonomia, which is, I suppose, identical before the law. But yet even they, firstly, they had their way of life was based on their religious convictions, but even they didn't give the same rights to women and to slaves and non-citizens of the Greek state, only free males. And why? Because the Greeks believed that you treat identical things equally. Now, of course, they shouldn't. There's no basis for them to say that slaves are not equal to free people, free men. But their basis for equality, from a materialistic basis, is that with that which is identical should be treated equally. What is not identical cannot be treated equally. And there's no other justification for that. And anyone who believes in equality is really following an affectation from the Christian past of Europe. But we live in a secular world. We've now lost the ability to justify what our predecessors were able to justify based on their religious convictions. And many liberal philosophers have noticed this. They talked about equality, and they said, Joel Feinberg said, equality is not grounded on anything more ultimate than itself, and it is not demonstrably justifiable. Isaiah Berlin said that equality cannot be defended or justified other than by reference to itself. So just believe it. You can't. There's no justification for it. And of course, Will Kimlicker, another liberal theorist, said the fundamental argument is not whether to accept equality, but how to interpret it. So really, they don't want to discuss if it can be justified or not. So then this raises a question as to then why equality? What does equality produce? And what are we actually aiming? There must be something greater than equality that we're trying to get at, we're trying to strive for. Now, you might say that, well, perhaps we should treat everyone as having exactly equal, identical rights under the law, rights and privileges and abilities. And this is just a practical, just something practical. Let's not talk about the theory, just something practical. We should implement that. And what you see in some of the redresses which are called for in the West, for example, they say that they will have quotas for boards and ensure that women have at least, let's say, 40% quota on managerial boards. But if you were really into equality, we would expect to have 40% quotas of women in bomb disposal experts, soldiers, gutter cleaners, miners, and slaughterhouse workers. Why do we not see any calls for 40 to 50% women quotas for those jobs, which are mostly done by men? If you want to talk about equality and redressing imbalances, they've noticed that men live 10% shorter lives than women. Could you say, in the name of equality, that men should now be given 10% more resources than women to redress the natural balance? Because women have 10% more experience of life. When more 10%, you could say 10% more enjoyment of life. So then men should be given 10% more resources to equal out that natural inequality. We get to these kind of absurdities when we try to equal both sides of the equation. And we don't, but the problem is, we haven't discussed what we are trying to achieve, what objective that we're trying to look into. Now, I think I want to ask a pertinent question, really, is are men and women identical? Are they actually identical? Now, in essence, in intelligence, you know, virtually yes, or if not yes, completely. Scientists are coming up with different conclusions and things, but generally speaking, there's no evidence to show that men and women in their intelligence are different from each other at all whatsoever. There is some debate as to whether men can multitask and women can focus as much as men, but that's debated by scientists, and I'm not a scientist, so I'm not going to go into that discussion. But there was interesting discussions, like by Lewis Wolpert, who wrote the book Why Can't a Woman Be More Like a Man? The Evolution of Sex and Gender. But there are some things which are undeniable, which are different between men and women. The propensity, obviously, men to be stronger, have more stamina and are faster. Testosterone, the rate of testosterone production in men is 20 times more than women per day. If you were to get a blood sample of a man and woman, find that the man would have 5 times more testosterone than women. Tests have shown that children exposed to greater testosterone, including females, are more likely to be engaged in what we call rough and tumble play, according to psychologists who've done experiments on this and done observations of this. So testosterone plays a part, surely. And if an alien came to Earth and saw men and women, what would the alien conclude as to why men and women look different from each other? What would the alien think? Alien not being subject to our prejudices or our dogmas, what would the alien look if it was just analysing us as creatures? What would they say? What would they look at? Say, why is there a chromosomal difference? What does the chromosomal difference mean? Why is it that men have tendency to have more greater upper body strength, 10% more stamina? What, you know? Why don't we see sports where men and women can compete in the same sport? So for weightlifting or for boxing or for wrestling or for sprinting, why you have gender segregation in sports? And you know, you won't see any of the Daily Mail or the Tory Party couldn't start being outraged at segregation of sports. Of course, it only applies to Muslims in university events sometimes. So why is that then? This is really the obvious. So what does it mean? You know, what does it mean? Hormonal difference? Again, I'll leave this more to scientists who are investigating and looking at the evidence. But there is clear behavioural differences because of testosterone. I mean, there's more men in prison than women by far. I think it's 80-90% is men in prison, not women. Why is that? Is that just nurture? Is this something about our acculturation? It has to be something based in some aspect of why there, you know, women have 2X chromosomes and we have an XY chromosome. There has to be a better explanation. So then, now I've discussed that men and women are not identical, but we are talking about equality, and I wanted to ask the question, what does equality, what should it aim for? What higher value than equality are we trying to achieve, and how can we justify it? Well, as the Swiss philosopher Henri Frédéric Emiel said, liberty, equality are bad principles. The only true principle for humanity is justice, and justice to the feeble is protection and kindness. And what the Quran says regarding the whole purpose of revelation of messengers coming down to mankind is elaborated in this verse of the Quran. We believe God says, we sent our messengers with clear signs and sent down with them the book and the measure or the balance in order to establish justice amongst the people. So the higher ideal is justice. And justice is giving people what they need, what they deserve. This is what Islam does. So in Islam, if criminals are punished and other people are not punished, or people who are not criminals are not punished, we don't say this is an inequality with treating people who are both human. We say the criminals who commit an act of crime deserve the punishment, and those who didn't do not deserve that. And this is where justice it would be more consistent than merely saying equality. Now, how does the Quran talk about the value of men and women in the eyes of God? Well, the Quran says very clearly in Surah Al-Imran, it says, God is saying, I do not waste the deed of any doer among you, any male or female. The one of you is as the other. So in the eyes of God, men and women are intrinsically or essentially equal in the eyes of God. But we also see this also in regards to race. So we see the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "O people, your God is one, your father is one," referring to Adam alayhi salam. "No preference of an Arab neither over a non-Arab, nor of a non-Arab over an Arab, or red over black, or black over red, except for the most righteous. Verily, the most honored of you is the most righteous." So we all start out fundamentally equal, but those who rise up in ranks over others is based purely on your morality, on your virtue. How you choose to be, how you choose to act will raise your rank. And the great thing about that is we all have equal access to equal capability to be righteous or not righteous. But we notice that the Quran also talks about just the condition of humans, where God says that He raises some humans up in ranks and He gives to some and doesn't give to others, and to test those of what He's given. So there are people who are rich in society, and there are people who are poor in society. Should we remove, if we want to be truly, you know, egalitarians or absolute egalitarians, we should take the money from the rich to equalize it with the poor and become communists? Would that be a good solution? No, and experiment was tried for 70 years and failed catastrophically with the Soviet Union. However, what Islam views the purpose of why there are people who are rich or people who are more healthier than others, our understanding of this is not that God is capricious or He's unjust. But what the Quran says is that when God gives something to some people, some either a blessing of some kind, equal to that, or commensurate to that, there is an equal responsibility that goes along with it. So a rich person on the day of judgment will have to account for what they did with their money, and did they spend it on the poor? Did they help people with what they were given? And it will be harder for a rich person to get into paradise than a poor person, because they have more things they have to be accountable for. And so ultimately, if you're given something, you're also given a commensurate amount of responsibility alongside it. And that, as in Islam, we call equality, ultimately. I'll just give an example. So we're not allowed to carry around, let's say, guns in the society. In London, in England we're not, in America you are, but in England you're not allowed to carry around guns. So if you were to see a policeman on the streets carrying around a pistol or a gun, as we see in some places around London, I don't know about Leicester, but you probably saw a few of them at some point, would we say, that's not fair? How comes they get to carry around guns and we don't get to carry around guns? That's not fair. Why do they get that privilege? But we wouldn't say it was a privilege. Why? Because we expect the police to put their lives on the line lest some criminal comes out and they have to stop that criminal and protect the rest of society. So they're given the ability to carry the gun, but at the same time they have to put their life on the line to protect those who don't have guns. So we're not saying, so no one will ever say the police are there's an inequality between the police and the general public, because alongside the police's privileges, they also have a commensurate amount of responsibilities that we don't have, commensurate amount of responsibilities. And this is what Islam considers to be equality, overall equality. But first I want to talk about and this is a very big misconception obviously, is what are the rights of women in Islam, because this topic is related to. No one came in to this lecture thinking, I've heard so many bad things about, you know, men not having enough rights in Islam compared to women, so I want to see what this topic is going to answer. No one thought that, unless you're a men's rights activist. So let me describe a bit more about what Islam gives women and their rights to defeat some misconceptions, because I want to try to contextualize what I've said. So what rights do women gave? And these are rights, most of these rights women never had prior to Islam, especially in the Arabian Peninsula. So unlike what happened in the West and up until I think just last century, where they had this concept called couverture, which was basically women couldn't own property, their husbands owned their property and were even legally liable for them. So women were deprived of of their own responsibilities towards their own property. And so, and sometimes a rich woman, men would like to marry her in English culture, for example, because they would take her property and be able to be the executors of it and owners of it and disposers of the property. In Islam, women have the right to own their own property, of which no one can touch the property. So they keep their property. When they get married, they keep their name. Their husband has no right to their property whatsoever. They have rights from their husband, which the husband has to provide. There's no choice on the matter. The husband must provide financial support to the woman in during the marriage. She does not have to spend a single penny on her husband, even if she is rich and he is poor. The obligation is for a man to look after the wife financially, so she doesn't have to pay any money out of her own pocket. In marriage, she's given a marriage gift or dowry, according to an English translation of that, which is usually can be a considerable amount, sum of money. If divorced, the man must pay alimony to the wife and ensure that she is kept off the street and not penniless or made into a vagrant. The women have the right to vote in Islam. Now, what I mean by voting is the Pledge of Allegiance. In Islamic leadership discourse, the leader can only be the leader once the people give the leader the Pledge of Allegiance. So the people legitimate the leader. And the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, who was the first leader of the Muslim community, he requested the Pledge of Allegiance from both men and women. So we didn't need to have suffragettes movements. We didn't need to have dawdling over whether women can have equal political participation to select the leader and wait 1,000 years up until only just last century for women to get the vote. 1,400 years ago, women were given equal access and equal responsibility to legitimate the leader of the Muslim world. We also see that women have the right to work and own their own business. The Prophet's wife, Khadija, radiallahu anha, she was a successful businesswoman. In fact, she actually employed Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. So that was his boss. And women have a right to education. Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, said that seeking knowledge is an obligation on men and women. There was a case where some women complained to the Prophet Muhammad when they were trying to attend to listen to him, men were crowding around the front of him and they couldn't have access to him to ask him questions and learn from him. And so he gave women-only days where women can have direct access and without being disturbed by some rambunctious males. We see that women have the right in Islam not to be abused physically or emotionally. One of the companions of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, asked the Prophet, "What do you command us? What do you say to us with regards to how we should treat our wives?" And he replied, "Give them food from what you have for yourself, clothe them by which you clothe yourself, and do not beat them, and do not insult them." In another narration, because do not impute ugliness to their face. So we see that in Islam, women can't be insulted, they can't be degraded, and they can't be certainly can't be beaten. I would dare argue that women don't have the right not to be insulted in Western culture. In the marriage, many husbands and wives can insult and abuse each other, and it's not necessarily falls foul of the law. Although people are now discussing about what is verbal domestic abuse being possibly not a form of domestic abuse, that's still being discussed. But we say that it is wrong for even the first insult to be uttered from the mouth. That is wrong, and we stop it. We nip it in the bud. So, a woman has a right not to be insulted and to be protected from verbal abuse as well as physical abuse. Women have the right to choose who she marries in Islam. So we see there was a case where the Prophet Muhammad saw someone was approached by a woman who said that her father had coerced her into marrying a gentleman. And so the Prophet said, "Well, do you want me to dissolve the marriage?" And she said, "No, I actually quite like him, but it's for the principle." So, and many other narrations that reiterate the same. In Islam, women have the right to her husband's time, affection, and sexual satisfaction by law. So so a husband can't abscond or neglect his wife. In the West, under the law system, which is based on individualism, where you're all individuals, you can do what you want. You don't have to have any responsibilities to your wife if you're a guy. You can go out with your mates, you can ignore her, you can come home, not even speak to her. And that seems to be, that's not against the law, that's not wrong, apparently, in the Western legal system. But in Islam, the woman can take her husband to court and demand those rights. Because this is the thing, though. Islam understands that we're human beings. Human beings need things from each other. We are social creatures. We're not individuals or autonomous islands that don't have any interaction with anyone else, and we're just happy when we're by ourselves. If that's the case, go live in a desert island and see how happy you will be with no humans around you. Right? As human beings, we need reciprocal relationships with each other. So Islam isn't individualist or believes in autonomy, because humans are not autonomous, full stop, even by nature. If no one taught you how to even speak a language, you would never develop it spontaneously. And right now, there's amongst anthropologists and sociologists, they're still wondering how language first came about, because humans don't seem to be able to generate it. They have to be taught it, and they can't generate it spontaneously. This is still a big discussion. So women have the right to, obviously, dignity and respect. And if the husband is negligent in any of his obligations, if he is rebellious to his obligations towards her, he can take her to court. So she can take him to court, and he can get punished. So this is the rights that women have in Islam, which I dare say don't exist to the full extent in the Western legal system. So this is what we consider to be rights. Now, I suppose if a men's rights activist guy was here in the audience, or girl, there are women men's rights activists too, they'd probably argue now that Islam is against men's sexual autonomy, because it forces men to satisfy the needs of their wife. Because for them, them and feminists, they're opposite number, they are individualists. And so individuals, they believe, should not be compelled to do anything. They exist for themselves. In Islam, we believe that we exist for God, and in doing so, we exist to serve each other, because we're a species. We're not just an individual. Now, Islamic society throughout history saw great women businessmen, great women leaders, great women scholars, jurisprudence. The modern university, as we'd understand it, was actually set up by a wealthy female businesswoman in Morocco, in modern-day Morocco, 1,000 years ago. We see that the scholar Sheikh Akram Nadri, who looked through historical documents, and he found 8,000 female scholars from the early times of Islam, who were Islamic scholars, jurisprudence, 8,000. Reason why he kept it, he said he stopped it at 8,000 because it was just too much, and so he just had to, he had to publish his book by a deadline. So he capped at 8,000 and didn't continue documenting, but he documented 8,000 scholars before he had to stop, and so on. So in Islam, we don't see that women have a deficiency of intellect at all. Women, there was in the time of Caliph Omar was a companion of the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, and then succeeded him in leadership after Abu Bakr as the head of the Muslim world. And he had an advisor, a political advisor, advising him on political strategy and with dealing with people's needs, and it was a woman. He also employed a street judge, not to be confused with Judge Dredd, the Islamic concept of a street judge, but a street judge who would go to marketplaces and ensure that people weren't cheating each other, weren't being deceptive, and this street judge was a woman. So Caliph Omar, and this is all in 7th century. Right, this is not, last century, or this is 7th century. We had women being judges, women being scholars. Some of the greatest Islamic scholars from history, like Imam Abu Hanifa, Imam Malik, Imam Shafi, even Imam Bukhari, were all students at one point in time of female scholars. So they were students learning from women scholars. So we didn't have this rule that we don't have a clergy. And secondly, we don't have a clergy, and we don't have a restriction on women from attaining positions or teaching about Islamic knowledge. In fact, it's 40% of narrations about the Prophet Muhammad's life in Sunni narrations are narrated by a woman, which is Aisha radhiyallahu anha, which was one of the Prophet's wives. So in Islam, women can work. Women actually can even join the army voluntarily. Obviously, for men, being a reservist is obligatory in Islam. But for women, they can voluntarily join the army. We saw women who were voluntarily joining naval forces. Women can be, I said, positions of political consultation, judges, scholars. So in Islam, we didn't have any restriction on women education, women entrepreneurship. But I would say, more importantly, gender just really wasn't an issue. In the West, we're so fixated by gender, we group people into so many different categories. We even have categories for race, the black community and the white community, as if your color of your skin somehow affects your culture. Or even sexual preference, where they say that this is the gay community. I say, how does your sexual preference create an entire culture? You know, we categorize humans into these groups, and we say we try to say this group has to have also bits of power of this or that. In Islam, it was irrelevant. We transcended this groupism or identification groups or identification politics, which is commonplace this day, and it didn't matter. If you were a scholar and you met the grade, you were a scholar, regardless of your skin color, regardless of your gender, it was just irrelevant. They didn't even consider it. No one complained that Omar had a female street judge or a female who was advising him. No one cared. It was not, as long as she was doing her job, it was not an issue. So we completely transcended sexism. This is actually a problem which happened in the West. Now, but where there are differences or functional considerations is actually just related to the private sphere, not the public sphere. And the private sphere is the family. The fundamental unit of society in the Muslim political philosophy is family, not individuals and not the community. Communists would say the society is the fundamental unit of society. Liberalism, or political individualism, if you want to call it like that, believes individuals are the fundamental unit of society. But in Islam, we consider it to be the family is the fundamental unit of society. The family gave birth to you. An individual, you didn't give birth to yourself as individuals. You came from families. Your families nurtured you. It's the first support mechanism that most of us had. It's what taught us language, what taught us morals, and what nurtured us. It's the family. So then really what Islam tries to do is it takes the differences between men and women and tries to produce a symbiotic relationship to create an efficient family structure, which is fair to all and involves reciprocal relationships. Because I said we're social creatures; we're not autonomous individuals as liberalism would have it. So, what does the Quran say about this? The matter of the family. Well, first and foremost, the Quran says that men are the protectors and maintainers of women because God has made one of them to excel the other. Some people translate that as maybe like physical strength and so on. And because they spend to support them from their means. So men support and maintain women and protect women. There must be some reason why men are physically stronger than women, why nature, evolution, if you believe, or any whatever you want to believe, why the basis for made men different to women. And in Islam, it's interesting. People say that the foremost consideration in Islam must be men, and women are just tag-alongs. But this is not how the Quran describes it. If anything, the Quran describes the purpose of men to revolve around women, not all the way around. So our job as men in the family is just to be the protector and maintainer of women. So we are the ones which revolve around the nucleus, and the nucleus is the woman of the family. And the Quran continues. It says, and women shall have rights similar to the rights against them according to what is equitable, but men will have a degree of responsibility over them. So how Islam organizes the family is that it aims to protect women, it aims to see that they are maintained and they don't have to worry about where their next meal is coming from or to feel vulnerable or to feel exposed. So this is how Islam tries to organize the family relationship. And it's actually done to honor the woman, not done to because she is somehow weak or incapable and so on. It's not how Islam looks at the matter. First and foremost, the Islamic perspective of the woman within the family context is actually gives her more respect than the father. So according to a narration of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, when a man came up to him and asked him, he said, "O Prophet of God, who should I respect, my father or my mother? You know, who should I respect more, my father or my mother?" So the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Your mother." And then he goes, "Also, and then my father." And then he said again, "No, your mother again." And then he asked, "And then my father?" "No, mother again." And then he said, "Father." So the mother is respected three times more than the father because her position in the family is so key. It's so important. She gives birth to the future of mankind. That's not something which is worthless or meaningless like some modern-day feminist advocates like to portray, not all feminist advocates, but some modern-day feminist advocates like to portray that women having a motherly role is somehow diminutive, that if only a woman can only have value if she contributes economically to society. And that's a very materialistic way of looking at human worth. So a woman's worth is only how much she can contribute economically to society. That's very materialistic. So the Quran and the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam's teachings gave women three times more respect than the father in a society, in the family. Also, the Quran commanded men to live with women on a footing of kindness and equity. And it also says, if you dislike something in them, it may be that you dislike a thing which God brings about it through a great deal of good. So it even tells men not to be judgmental on women and not to nitpick or find fault. It said if you find something you think is a fault, maybe God has put that there and he'll give you a source of goodness. Maybe there's a hidden good in that. So don't judge women. Don't find fault or complain about them. So value women. Islam respects women so much that it tries to protect them from being viewed as sexual objects. If you actually want to see how a society values life, see how a society values the source of human life, women. So we see that in capitalism, where everything is a commodity, women, and feminists complain about this, that women are made into sexual objects to sell products, that they've become one-dimensional creatures related to their beauty and their physical appearance. They're judged by their physical appearance. Women are made to feel by society now that inadequate or invisible if they don't put up makeup or don't show the most beautiful face they can put on and beautiful appearance they can put on. They feel like people won't give them attention. They won't attain any position of power or have anyone's time or even get married to Mr. Right. So this is how society, and this is what some feminists have complained about modern society, Western society rather. This is the situation that's been created. But what Islam did is, when it ordained protections like the hijab and the niqab, now first and foremost, Islam aims to remove sexual politics from society, from both men and women. Most men are not allowed to show body shape, and we're not allowed to expose below from the navel to the knee. So any guys here who go to gym and somehow coincidentally just like to wear very tight fitting clothing, pay attention to that. You're not allowed to do that if you're Muslim. So as Islam, it protects both men and women from sexual objectification. And it's not, people say that, oh, is it because you think they're going to get raped? You're protecting them from rape? So it's got nothing to do with the issue of rape. The issue is the dignity of humans. That is the fundamental issue first. First and foremost, forget about rape. Even if there was zero rapes in any society, the fundamental issue is the dignity of human beings. That's what has to be protected. Both men and both women. The head covering and the jilbab, or the body covering, is the purpose of it, is actually a woman's passport into the world. It's her passport. It's her ability to go outside and pursue what she wants professionally, educationally, in a respectful manner, without being accosted or viewed in a certain way or judged on her appearance at all whatsoever. We remove the issue of appearance from society and instead replace it with only valuing the content of people's hearts and the content of their characters. That's the purpose of hijab. You'll also see that in Western society, when you see obviously women on the streets who are being told by fashion magazines and pressured by billboards and adverts to look a certain way, that this causes a lot of trouble just between women. So women become envious or jealous of each other. They judge her by looks themselves. So women will judge themselves by looks, judge each other by looks. So now that women actually now degrade them, are robbed of dignity even from how they look between themselves. And the problem has also got to the point where Even if a woman is married to a husband or in this society a boyfriend, sometimes she feels insecure that there are other women who are obviously very attractive and are displaying that attraction in society, and you know that her husband or her boyfriend's eyes might stray. And now even vice versa with men being as well, Is that a society whereby, you know, humans can live cohesively, can live in a sense of peace and tranquility when we're all competing with each other to outdo each other, to be more attractive than each other, to attract attention away from people, other people's spouses? This is not conducive to, I just think, any kind of peaceful or enlightened society. That's the point. So Islam tries to dignify humans by removing these social compulsions for beauty. And what we've seen that in the West there are some very horrific practices which are done, which are now are totally legal. You know, when they bring up the issue of a female genital mutilation, which in Islam is not an Islamic practice whatsoever. It's a traditional practice in many parts of the world. Many of these parts of the world are not Muslim at all. It's just practiced in that area of the world for centuries. But when they raise the issue of female genital mutilation, I often wondered why they called the issue they called it was female genital mutilation. Because in the West, you can undergo, and women are increasingly doing so, going to cosmetic surgeons and undertaking labiaplasties, which by the very definition is mutilation of the female genitalia. But they say, oh, that's okay, because it's consensual. Okay, then so maybe you should then describe the problem with FGM as non-consensual female genital mutilation. Don't just say female genital, because you seem to be okay with FGM if it's done by the consent of the woman in a plastic surgery somewhere in the city. So they don't have a problem with FGM as long as it's consensual. So the issue really is consent. Whereas in Islam, we don't believe that people should have to mutilate themselves to look attractive or look beautiful. We don't believe that, and we try to eliminate social compulsion for women to look a certain way, like airbrushed models in a picture, such as, you know, women are forced now, in some cases, they feel they have the need to be anorexic, bulimia is on the rise. We see that people inject collagen or Botox, which I believe is derived from botulism, which is some kind of, which is very nasty if you think about it. What, just to get the inflammation of the lips? I view these as mutilations of the women, and it was mutilations induced by social pressure and social compulsion. I think that's a kind of oppression on women. I think that's a kind of forcing them to look a certain way in order to get some kind of attention or elevation in that society. So the hijab and jilbab is actually there to liberate women from these very negative social forces and eliminate sexual tension from society, sexual politics from society. Because you don't go out into society for intercourse or sex, you go out into society to work, to study. You don't go out, you know, sexual intercourse happens in the privacy of your own home. So why are we bringing sexual politics out into the wider society? Now, people might say that, well, why is it that women have to cover more of their body than men? This is an argument they bring, saying, isn't this an inequality? Is this unfair? But the argument is very simple, is that, anatomically speaking, obviously there's more women have more anatomically related reproductive matters upon them compared to men, which is that's the nature of it. But what you'll also find in even in Western systems, they also give differential rights based on biology as well. I'll give you one example. So one example I like to cite is this: it is said that men and women have equal reproductive rights. And what you'll find with many feminist advocates is they'll talk about women's reproductive rights. And usually the right to abortion, they say, right to abortion. So they have reproductive rights. The right to abort their fetus or to see it to term. But a simple question, do men have equal reproductive rights to women? Do we believe in equality in this matter? And they'll say, okay, yes, they do. Okay, so if a man, obviously, he has intercourse with a woman, she's pregnant, he wants to see his fetus to term. She doesn't want to see the fetus to term, she wants to abort it. Will the man's rights, equal rights to reproduction, be respected or have any say in the matter? No. So whether she wants to terminate or see it to term, he'll have no say in it. And if she wants to see it to term against his will, then he'll be forced to pay child support by law, even though he had no say in the matter. Does that sound like equal reproductive rights between men and women? Of course, people will say, but women have to carry the child or carry the fetus. I say, okay, fine. So you're saying that different biological circumstances causes different rights. And so in principle, they also agree that different the biological differences necessitate different rights. So the print they don't disagree with the principle. It's just now where we put these barriers. Of course, in Islam, we don't believe in obviously abortion. We believe obviously sex must be within marriage. Reason being is marriage offers the protections to women and protections to men and the protections to children as well. And the man can't abscond. In an individualist society, the man can abscond. He doesn't have to take care of the woman. He can just walk away with no other obligations towards her or her children, and she'll be left literally holding the baby. So, how Islam to round up how Islam deals with the issues between men and women is not one where they say we must have exact identical equality, and that's how to bring justice, because we see that identical equality doesn't bring justice, because men and women are different, and they're going to have different matters, as even in the West, we're given differential reproductive rights, even they have to concede. So what Islam aims to do is to create equal justice for both, depending on their needs and their circumstances. Someone mentioned, they said, you say that a man is responsible for a woman, but what if a woman is richer, she's more dominant than her husband, and she wants to be the one in charge, and she wants to be the one who takes care of her husband? Well, the great thing about Islam is that the exceptions usually resolve themselves. Because if she was marrying an alpha male, let's just say, and they would just argue and bicker as to who, you know, as to who decides what in the family and who looks after who in the family. But naturally, a woman who's naturally very dominant would probably marry a man who's very who's not so dominant. And so what you'll get in Islam is that as long as the man and the woman consent amongst each other to an arrangement, then that could be acceptable. So as long as there's consent on both sides. So for example, a woman can choose not to insist her husband support her voluntarily. She can voluntarily decide not to request her right from her husband to financially support her if she's rich or whatever or what have you. And that will be the case. The husband, you know, won't be punished if he stays at home and looks after the kids and the woman goes out to work, as long as it's consensual between the two of them. So the exceptions usually resolve themselves. But the guided framework is for people who want to have a what is now called a traditional marriage, whereby they want to be looked after by their husband, they want to be protected, and they want to ensure that their husband gives them the needs that they deserve as human beings. And so the standard marriage is given as not just a guideline as well, but as a fundamental protection. We never faced this problem, the battle of the sexes, which you saw in the last century and probably still ongoing. If you listen to the discussions between the MRAs and the feminists, the battle of the sexes, where everyone's now fighting each other for their needs, and they're fighting each other. And the problem is, of course, that under individualism, no one has obligations towards each other. All right. So how do we resolve this when what you're fighting for, you're actually fighting for to be treated in a nice way? But all the law looks at is not to treat her in a bad way, but you don't have to treat her nicely. There's no obligation. What Islam did is it removed the power from the men, it removed the power from the women, and gave it to God, and gave it to the Islam. And Islam gives justice to both men and women. So what is one group over another, but rather there is both groups cooperating with each other for a greater good, which is more important and sovereign than any other group's interests and ideas. And what we see, what the Quran says, it says that the believers, men and women, are friends one of the other. They enjoin what is right and they forbid what is wrong, and they establish worship and pay charity, and they obey God and his messenger, and for these God will have mercy on them. And this is how Islam brings justice to both, by ensuring that both submit to justice. Thank you.
Thank you very much for that amazing talk. We hope that's clarified a few points. We will open the floor for Q&A, if that's okay. If you don't want to ask out loud, there should be a paper going around with some questions you can write down there.
Okay. Questions, comments, or criticisms. I also welcome criticisms. So please, if I've said something that strongly outraged you, please feel free to voice it, and we can have a discussion. I'll let you come back you, sister.
Yeah, I found that very interesting. I didn't agree with everything you said, but I understand the justifications. And a lot of where Islam is, where the position of justice that you're talking about comes from. But one of the things I don't think you spoke about was the things that a lot of people pick up on is the fact of Muhammad having so many wives, and the fact that in Islam is it allowed to have many wives. What do you think this says about gender equality?
So, just to reiterate, so you're saying that why did the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam have many wives, and how does this relate to gender equality? How does that relate to gender equality? Just out of curious, what would be your?
No, I mean, is there an equivalent right for females to have many husbands? Is this a case of if these women consent to being one of many wives, what did this say about the position and value of women?
Okay. Well, first and foremost, just look at the context of polygamy. So yes, Islam does permit polygamy. It doesn't command polygamy. There's a difference. It doesn't say, you know, thou shalt have many wives. It's actually an exception. Why? Because at the time of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, the pagan Arab culture, men could take any number of wives they want and give no rights to any of those women. I mean, there was no women's rights or rights for women against their husbands. And so it was a very anarchic system. It was a very unfair system. Women's kind of needs were not looked at by the pagan Arab culture. So what the Quran did is actually it put a cap on the number of wives people can take. It says, well, absolute maximum is 4. If you can treat them equally. And believe me, if you read the later verse, it says that people, you know, that men would never be able to treat all their wives absolutely equally. But you have to treat them equal. You know, you have to have separate houses. You have to spend equal time. What you give to one, you have to give to the others, which is virtually nigh on impossible for most men. 99.999% of men. But there are some men who feel they are able to, and want to engage in that. And so that is to regulate, rather than just abolish, rather than just having a blanket abolition. For those men that do so, there is the permissibility of it. Now, there are 3 arguments I'd put for the issue of polygamy and why we don't see polyandry in Islam, so multiple husbands for the wife. First and foremost, I could quote a scientific kind of observation. This is just an observation, really. Biologists and zoologists have noticed a study of sexual dimorphism, that the more different the male is to any of the female in any species, the more likely that species is to be polygamous. So, a case of a swan, the male and the female swan look virtually identical, then monogamous. But let's say with chickens, you have hens and cockerels. Obviously, it's polygamy. You'll see with various apes and monkeys and so on and so forth. There's baboons and so on. There's polygamy. So we see that this is what has been noticed. So and where they've and they then they tried to look at humans and say, well, what would, based on our theory of sexual dimorphism being a predictor of polygamy, humans are somewhere in between monogamy and polygamy. This is what they generally say on the matter. But just because scientists say it doesn't mean that's a value in of itself. It's just an interesting observation. I just put it out there. But there are 2 reasons why Islam allows polygamy, or rather the regulation of it, for the 0.0001% of males, and doesn't allow a polyandry. The first point is that in Islam, the male is responsible for and the protector and provider of the female in the family unit. So if you were to have more than one, if a woman was to have more than one husband, there'd be basically 2 people who are responsible for the same person, and they'd be fighting and jostling and so on, because they both are meant to have responsibility of the same person, and there'll be arguments and disputes. The second argument is actually biological differences. One man may impregnate 4 women, you know, at the same time. Well, not at the same time, but. In generally speaking, let's say within a week, he can have all 4 of his wives pregnant. But a woman only has 1 womb. So if she has 4 husbands, do each of those husbands have an equal chance or right to have their offspring with the wife? Maybe one husband's more virile than the other husband, or that, you know, their gametes are stronger, and one husband's progeny would predominate over another. So all the husbands won't have an equal right or to have equal chance to have their progeny. Whereas what they've seen with a man that has multiple wives is that they produce really large families. It doesn't seem to inhibit the women's chances to get pregnant, but just because she's sharing the same man. Whereas it will certainly inhibit a man's chances to have his offspring if he has to share that one womb with other men. So biological differences would seem to be would necessitate differences in that matter. So that would be the argument why Islam would prohibit polyandry but not polygamy. And polygamy is regulated, not encouraged, in Islam. But as for the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam having multiple wives, which is what you mentioned originally, well, if you actually saw, many of these women were widows and were very, very old women, and he married them. A lot of them were connected to the heads of tribes, and the Prophet Muhammad would marry a woman of a noble into a tribe to unite the tribe with him. So much like how I suppose how everyone really kind of back then would intermarry to create unity, but he would intermarry these women who were, these weren't very young women or so on. These were, you know, most of them were war widows, and they were generally very 30s, 40s, and so on, so sometimes 50s. So it wasn't for any kind of physical desire. I'm gonna marry many women just to have a harem of young virile women. No, it was actually to create unity between the tribes. That would be the cause of why the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam had more than four wives in that case. Any other questions, comments, or criticisms? You, sister.
You just mentioned hijab, but you didn't explain what's hijab exactly. And I think because now it's very debatable topic, or what's the hijab and janabib as well.
Okay, well, the precise form of the clothing can vary depending on the culture of any people who are Muslim, but rather the clothing has to achieve two objectives, which are not really debated amongst classical scholars, amongst the companions of the Prophet, or even in the narrations of the Prophet Muhammad himself or the Quran. And really, it is that the head is covered, the bosom is covered, and the body shape is covered. Well, okay. Well, yes, there is the verse dealing with. Sorry.
And very specific. There's mentioned in the Quran specifically. That
well, yes. When it says, you know, to draw the head covering, the himar over the bosoms, as the head covering, and to cover, use that to cover the bosoms, was mentioned in the verse of the Quran. So it is mentioned, and the head. Sorry. No, there's another verse that says I believe the Arabic word is the himar on the head covering, which means head covering, and draw it over the bosoms.
They have to put scarf on their
jalabi. No, so to draw it over.
Exactly.
The command says to draw, so they were having a head covering and to draw it over the bosoms as well. That's what the verse of the Quran says. So it's the head covering and it was actually commanded to actually draw it, because some women were wearing head covering, but they were leaving their, you obviously,
is there any
exposed.
Any word means head or hair?
Head covering, yeah. The word meaning head, yeah, means head covering. Any Arabic speakers want to contradict me on that? If you feel free, or to come back and say that's not the meaning of the word. So I accept that, but that's as far as I can tell, that's what the meaning also. But the thing is this: is that but there's a fundamental issue behind that question. First and foremost, in Islam, we don't believe that if a woman doesn't cover her hair, that she's naturally, she must be a woman of ill repute, or we don't view it like that, right? So this is not the Islamic understanding. Unfortunately, that can be some of the traditional cultural understandings in many of the Muslim world. But we believe it is commanded in Islam for the elevation of women in society and to allow them to go out and not be judged based on their physical looks. It's because of the culture of fashion, mostly coming from the West, from satellite and magazines and internet now, that women, especially in Muslim countries now, are feeling the pressure to change their appearance. I mean, for example, in Lebanon, which is a very westernized country, you're seeing plastic surgery going out of control, basically. why do women have to feel the need to actually butcher themselves or mutilate themselves to be accepted in society? I think that's horrific, and I blame the social pressure and the conditions which are making women feel inadequate unless they do these procedures. So, thank you. So, it's the hijab is meant to be actually be a liberation for women, that it tells the woman, you will be accepted and respected and listened to irregardless of what you look like. And that's the purpose of the hijab debate. And also at the same time, it's also it also can to reassure a woman that when her husband leaves every day for work, that he won't be looking at every woman, or it will help him. It will help him to lower his gaze. Obviously, a man has to lower his gaze anyway, irrespective. But what the Quran says in Surah Nisa is that humans are weak, right? The Quran doesn't expect humans to be perfect. That's the great thing about Islam is it's so merciful. It understands humans are weak. It doesn't expect us to be angels. That we are gonna sin. We are going to fall down. So in light of this, it tries to make it easy for us. Let's not tempt each other. Let's not compete with each other, and let's not try to outdo each other or to tempt each other's spouses away from themselves. And I've seen funny couples when I'm out and about. There's a man be sitting down with his girlfriend or wife, drinking coffee. A woman with a miniskirt walks by, and the man just like his gaze trails, and his girlfriend or wife just, you know, says, "Hey, I'm over here," or slaps him or whatever, right? Now you see, and you know what? Does she feel nice? Does she feel okay when to see her boyfriend stroke spouse do that? No, I don't think so. I don't think does she feel secure when she sees that being done? No. And even if he doesn't do it in front of her, does she feel secure knowing that there are women that look better than her? Of which can tempt her spouse away, you know, she doesn't feel secure. Even if you trust your spouse, most people don't feel secure, and vice versa, not just for women, but also for men. So Islam tries to remove the whole sexual politics and tensions and issues from society, because it doesn't benefit society. It doesn't benefit society at all. So let's go out in society and do what we're meant to do, which is being professional or educational, learning or helping each other, or doing charity, or doing a whole number of beneficial things without having this kind of, you know, sexual politics in society. This is the wisdom that Islam tries to give. Someone says, asked an interesting question, why are there no female prophets? This was a very interesting discussion. It reminded me of a discussion of scholars in Al-Andalus, where I'm from, Portugal, also Spain included. In history, during Islamic times, there was actually a discussion as to were there any female prophets. Some people actually posited that Mary, the mother of Jesus, that she was a prophet because she was given a message by an angel, and this would be the minimum requirement to be called a prophetess, rather. So some people have debated this matter. They said maybe Mary was a prophetess, but in Islam we don't really care the packaging of the message. We care about the message itself. So it's irrelevant whether the message was delivered by a male or a female, as long as the message was delivered. We don't worship the Prophet Muhammad, sallallahu alaihi wasallam. We worship the originator of the message he conveyed. So it's irrelevant, really, who actually delivers the message. We're not messenger-centric, like other religions might are. We worship only God. Someone made a quote, one man equals to two women. Is this an Islamic principle? It's not an Islamic principle, but by dint of so many narrations which are contradicted. In fact, one could argue that a mother is worth three fathers, if you want, according to some narrations, if you want to look at it like this. This was taken from perhaps a misunderstanding of a verse of the Quran which talked about witnessing financial contracts. There was basically at the time of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, women didn't get involved so much in finance and being a merchant and business. So they really weren't involved in finance. So the Quran almost gave a help to women for those who are involved in observing financial transactions. And really, what it is if you're going to write a contract or a financial transaction of some kind or promise financial transaction, that you can have two male witnesses, or you can have, you know, instead of one male witness, you can have two female witnesses. And then it explained in the Quran why two female witnesses. Because if there's any dispute about this contract and someone, you have to recall your witnesses. It says that the woman can give her testimony, and that her colleague can remind her if she makes a mistake. So it's not saying that women's memory is deficient, because many of the people who narrated the traditions of the prophets, so many people who actually transmitted, memorized traditions or sayings of the Prophet Muhammad were women. And no one said in Islamic scholarship that just because a woman like Aisha who transmitted 40% of Sunni narrations, 40% of all Sunni discourse on the Prophet Muhammad was narrated by a woman. No one says that these narrations are not as trustworthy because it was based on a woman's memory. No one says that. So really then, the only way you can really explain it is how the Quran explains it. Which is really, if anything, it's positive discrimination or actually helps. So if a woman's in the court and she just feels intimidated, she'll just have a colleague with her. And the colleague's job is only to remind her if she makes a mistake. That's what the Quran says. That's what the Quran says. Read it for yourself. So the other one will remind her if she makes a mistake. It doesn't say so they both will give testimony. It didn't say that. It says so that one will remind her if she makes a mistake. So there is no such thing as one man equals two women. One other misconception people will say is that because in cases of murder, if someone is murdered, if a man is murdered, due to manslaughter, so it's or accidental murder, that the financial compensation to the family is double that of the woman, or that the man's inheritance is doubled out of his sister. And they say, is this also meaning that men are equal to two women? No, it's just because, and this is very self-evident, men are obligated to look after women. So the extra portion of inheritance he gets will have to go on a woman, will have to be spent on his wife or his sisters or daughters or so. It'll have to be spent on women, basically. A man is obligated to spend on his wife. A wife is not obligated to spend on the man. With regards to if a man is killed in the family, that's a form that's you're eliminating their form of financial support in that family, and so the financial redress has to be doubled, because it's assumed the man will have to be providing for the family. You see, why? Because it's an obligation on the man to provide for the family. Now, really, the only argument anyone could say of anything which is not equal is they could say it's not fair that men have to provide for women. Why do men have to give women a dowry for marriage? That's not fair. I don't want to give women dowry. I don't want to look after them or pay for them. And so, and that would be a men's rights activist in the audience, perhaps, who might raise that. But that would be the only argument they could level. But men and women are equal in the eyes of God. There is no different valuations. This is only related to financial matters due to the fact that men and women have different obligations. Someone wrote, head cover is himar in Arabic. Yeah, okay, I said that. All you told, all you said, was very nice, but do you really believe that nowadays the women's are so well treated? Do you really man's put all that you said into practice? Okay. Is it in practice? No, I'm mostly not in the Muslim world. Why is that? Well, if you look at the Muslim world, these regimes, these nations are mostly the product of colonialism. And the problem with colonialism was it infused in Muslims very Victorian ideas of men and women conduct. So the idea that women should stay at home, or their place is in the home, or women shouldn't work, go out to work, is a very Victorian English idea, or even a French idea, which was imparted into the Muslim world. It's not actually indigenous to our worldview. When the British took over Egypt, they stopped women who were studying to become medical practitioners. They stopped that happened. They said that women shouldn't bother with being doctors. Men should be doctors. Women don't have to worry about that. The British did that, and they did that as part of civilizing the natives. So they civilized us by removing women's rights from that was practiced by Islam. The Muslim world is a product of what happened to us in history, and you know, as Muslims, what we are trying to do is we're trying to actually revive Islam in the Middle East. revive Islam in the Muslim world. And all the injustices you see in the Muslim world, some people say there's injustice against women and it's due to patriarchy, this conspiracy theory about this men ruling the world and so on and so forth. Well, the thing is this, in the Middle East, everyone's oppressed, right? The poor, the middle class, those who actually even speak about Islam are oppressed. Everyone's oppressed apart from various ruling elites. And do you think putting a woman will change the dynamic? Looking at Bangladesh. There are two, the government alternates between two female rulers, and yet there's torture and there's killing and there's suppression of political dissent in Bangladesh. So that's what I'm saying. Equality doesn't necessitate justice. So all you're really going to call for is saying, well, we believe that women should have an equal right to be dictators as much as men. is that going to bring justice? No. Right? So the problem in the Middle East is that Muslims aren't living by Islam. We're mostly illiterate about our own religion or belief system. When even discussing the Sharia, when I do many lectures on the Sharia, Muslims actually are as shocked about it as non-Muslims are, just coming into lecture. And what I've said is not really controversial or new, or it's actually old, basically. So and what's interesting was, in the time of the 18th century, people from Britain could travel around the world. And many well-to-do women traveled to Ottoman areas, Ottoman Turkey. And what they were absolutely shocked when they were writing about, they were shocked to see that women were business owners and they were patrons of hospitals and institutions of learning. And they even remarked that they've never seen any place in the world where women are as happy or have as much rights as in Ottoman Turkey, Ottoman Caliphate. Right, the Ottoman Caliphate. So this was in the 18th century. Wasn't that too long ago? So Islam gave women rights, and under traditional Islamic beliefs, women were given justice. But now, in secular regimes like Egypt, obviously Iraq, under Saddam Hussein, Syria, Bashar Assad, Algeria, I'd even say Saudi Arabia is also a secular regime, a monarchy, constitutional monarchy. That's not an Islamic system. Under these un-Islamic secular regimes, you're seeing oppression of women. You're seeing oppression of minorities. The Christians are being oppressed. I would say that they are being oppressed. The Yazidis got kicked out. The Christians have been kicked out many places after colonialism, after secularism. You saw people fighting each other. Even in other places where it's not predominantly Muslim, like India, Hindus and Muslims live side and Christians who converted live side by side for centuries. After colonialism, there's now the rise of fascist groups and of marginalization of minorities and oppression and many problems in secular, the democratic India. So colonialism didn't really do any favors for the Muslim world, and I would argue that what Muslims follow now is a post-colonialized, Victorian-influenced understanding of their culture, and they're completely illiterate as to what Islam says, and they certainly don't follow it. And the problem is getting them to actually follow it and to intellectually revive and rediscover their religion. Question, if you want to. Why two women witnesses? I think I mentioned that. Why do women get less inheritance compared to men? Okay, I think I mentioned that. You said that differences in Sharia pertaining to men and women are restricted to the private sphere, but there are rulings against women becoming qadis. Well, tell that to Caliph Omar, or becoming soldiers. No, women can join the army. Women joined the army at the time of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. Do you say that this is not a valid ruling? If it is a valid ruling, then don't the differences extend to the public sphere too? The obligation of men to join, to be in the army or be reservists, is certainly something beyond the private sphere, yes. But women aren't restricted from joining the army. Women can join the army. And at the time of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, we have narrations where a woman goes to the Prophet and asks him to join the fighting forces. And she is allowed to do so. And again, women being judges at the time of Caliph Omar, I already mentioned that example. So are these valid rulings? Are you saying that rulings from some modern day scholars? I would really take some of what I've heard from modern day scholars with a pinch of salt. and Pepper. Why, you know, classical scholars had a much better understanding. Why can women not be leaders in Islam of a country and nation? Okay, this is an interesting question. So why can't women not be leaders? You mean the caliph, basically. Why can't women be the caliph of Muslim society? Well, there's a very basic reason for this. The caliph is not, the position is not a right. Like, no one has a right to be the caliph. It's not a privileged position anyway. There's no perks in it. There's no extra money in it. In fact, you're accounted for what you do as the leader. You'll be accounted by the subjects for what you do. There is no perks you get with it, with being the caliph. You can't decide what the law is, because the law is set out in the Sharia. And if you you have to consult scholars, of which some of the scholars can be women, of course, who would say what the strongest opinion is, and the leader just has to execute the rules. He doesn't have a choice to say, "I'm gonna make laws to benefit the male population." No, you can't do that in Islam, because we don't segregate the population into male and female in that sense. To make them interest groups that have to be that can have equal access to the same power structure, we don't have that sexist dynamic in our society. So then, if the caliph is not a right, I mean, you can't put yourself up to be the caliph, right? The Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, anyone who asks for power, shouldn't get it, or doesn't deserve it, depending on how you translate it. So a person cannot ask to be a leader. You can't ask people to vote for you in Islam. The leader is really just the extension or the extrapolation of the military duty. The whole point of the caliph, his point of the caliph is to be the commander in chief of the military forces, of which men are obliged to be reservists. The caliph is chosen by a council, by the people, and so on, to undertake that role. Now, in that sense, it's not a privilege to undertake that role. It's not a right that belongs to anyone. In fact, it's actually an imposed role. People were made caliphs against their will. They didn't want to be the caliph. You must be the caliph, and this is the situation. So, in Islam, really, it's just that the caliph is really an extrapolation of the military obligation of men to be the protectors of society. That's really what it is. I suppose in one way, it's kind of commensurate to the Roman idea of the magister, the magister, which was a person selected in times of conflict to be the head, the military chief, commander in chief, and who would basically defend. And we see the Prophet Muhammad described the caliph as the shield of the people, behind which the people fight and protect themselves. So the caliph role is really an extrapolation of the military role, and the military role is an obligation upon men. And hence, because being an obligation upon men, a man is selected usually against his will. Not he couldn't ask for it to be the leader, and he must discharge the obligations of that position. Now, because you can't ask, because it's an obligation upon men, it's viewed as a burden, not as a privilege. Someone might ask, well, okay, but why can't a woman ask to be considered to be the leader and the problem, or the caliph rather? And the problem with that is that you immediately disqualify yourself by asking to get power in the first place, because you don't ask to get to become the caliph. You get selected to be the caliph, and usually under great protest, because there's no perks in it. It's one of the greatest burdens, depending on obviously. I suppose how you might view it, you could also view it as, I mean, like, what right do we have to impose the burden of becoming the supreme military leader, which must go to war, to women against their will, you know, when it's not an obligation for women to be part of the army? Whereas because all men are reservists, they are the pool of which you can select an appropriate candidate from, and they can't select themselves. So it's actually a burden role, not a privilege role. Power is not a privilege in Islam. It's not a right. It's a burden, and you'll be given it probably against your will, because you won't really covet it. And the leader has to give justice to all people, not just to their interest group or their racial group or their national group or their gender group. And that kind of gender politics has caused, identity politics has caused the problems in the Middle East, where you'll see different tribes or sects or races fighting each other for a stake in power, and deciding what happens in power. Whereas in Islam, the caliph is not the sovereign, he's not the king, He's only the executor. He has no choice in what laws to make. He's only there to discharge the duty and even put his life on the line to defend the Muslim community. So that's the issue. It's not that it's differential rights, because there is no right to be the caliph in Islam or to it's certainly not a privilege. What rights do women have in terms of housework and taking care of the family or the husband? So what rights do women have? Well, I mean, there's not actually express obligation in Islam to say that the woman must look after the house, clean the house, and mend the clothing. We actually know that the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam himself mended his own clothes and helped his wives cleaning the house. So there's no obligation in of itself that says, women, thou shalt clean the house, or iron the shirts, right? You won't find that in Islam. But what the rights that the husband has with regards to the woman, and I mentioned today already the rights the woman has over her husband, so there's also commensurate rights on the side. In that sense, the man has the right to be obviously respected by his wife, and to be and to have responsibility, and obviously she should facilitate or grant his reasonable requests. And one of the rights she has is that she can't be overburdened by her husband's requests. So if the husband makes requests more than she can facilitate, then she can ask for example, a housemaid, and she has to provide it, a housemaid. So any one of you who are budding husbands, don't make too much requests from your wife, otherwise you're going to have to pay for a housemaid. So yeah, and of course the other rights are of course that the woman must be provided. Okay, so I will. So the woman must be provided with the same quality of clothing, not necessarily the same clothing as her husband, and eat from the same and have the same kind of quality of food. So basically, the husband can't say, I'm obliged to provide for you food. Here's some gruel, and I'll have a nice roast beef dinner. No, she has to. Obviously, she has a right to share equally with what he has and what he enjoys from his own property. I'll take a question from the audience now, because I think I've read most of the papers here. So any questions, comments, or criticisms, or what people wanting to come back on what anything else said, you sister at the back.
You mentioned earlier that women obviously are allowed to work.
Yeah.
I've read somewhere that they're not allowed to travel without a male guardian. So why is that?
Okay, so you've read that women aren't allowed to travel without a male guardian. It's usually a long distance, so you know, like traveling halfway around the world, unescorted or alone, and it's just more for issues of protection rather than that the chaperone is going to make sure that she's not doesn't do infidelity or anything. It's not that. It's not the reason. The reason is just to ensure that she's secure by some means. Not, I mean, people have discussed obviously modern transport such as planes and trains, which will get you to long distances in very quicker time. And in essence, as long as the woman is protected or made, her security is guaranteed, that's really what the purpose is to ensure that her security is guaranteed wherever she goes. You hear obviously stories of unaccompanied women who go halfway across the world and have an experience really, bad things happen to them. And it's just, Islam doesn't want to see that happen, obviously, to women. So women's security is paramount, and it just has to be guaranteed so that she's not molested, or something, God forbid, nasty happens to her when she goes halfway across the world by herself to a place which she's not familiar with, or so on. So it's nothing to do with the inferiority of women. In fact, it's because women are valued that the security is considered to be more paramount than male security. So women's security is more important than even man's security. Man, you take care of yourself, but for women, we have to guarantee that she's safe and secure to travel and so on. And she could be traveling for business or traveling for whatever purposes she travels for, but it's just to maintain her security or assure that she's okay. You, madam.
From what you were telling us, it sounded like the Quran is very gender considerate, right? But then you just admitted before that there is actually a mismatch with what is saying was actually happening in many countries. So my question would be, what did you suggest that could be changed to diminish that gap, among other things, because that's also causing a lot of strong prejudice against Muslim people, even in Western societies. That regardless of the gender, there is this mental image that is extremely diminishing. that goes against with this information that you just gave us about the Quran.
Okay. Well, some of the problems are. Thank you. Some of the problems that we see again are due to. I mean, okay, to say it's cultural. The question is obviously where did that culture come from, and it either came from pre-Islamic culture or from post-colonial culture, which was mostly borrowed from. At the time of colonization, was mostly the Victorian culture and understanding. And if anyone who studies Victorian understanding of men and women's relations will know that a lot of what the Muslims do are very familiar with what the Victorians did, because the Muslims looked up to the Victorians as the colonists as the superior moral power, and they emulated what the Victorians, because women under Victorian times were considered to be fragile, weak, and must be looked after because this and even considered not, I mean, they couldn't own property, and the man had full control over the wife. So the Muslims looked up to this superior colonizing power and just emulated what they observed. So unfortunately, a lot of the problems in the Muslim world are due to us emulating Europeans 100 years ago.
Can you make a
final question, please? Final question, okay. So how to deal with it? Well, you know, when people think of, let's say, Sharia, they think, oh, women's education stops. On the Sharia, women's education stops. But, and they cite, for example, the Afghan Taliban, or they cite a section of the Pakistani Taliban, which was in the area where Malala was infamously shot. So, and they say, look at these people, they stopped women's education, right? But now, the thing is this, they don't pay attention to the many thousands and thousands of other Islamic movements which have women in their movements, who are political spokesmen. Even in Pakistan, we saw that in the cities, under many religious movements have schools where they teach men and women Islamic studies, for example. We see that in many of the groups that arose under the Arabic Spring, that women were you know, politicians under Islamic movements or groups that professed to want Islam. So people ignore those things. You know, it's called confirmation bias. We only look at the things which reinforce a particular prejudice we already have, and we just ignore, gloss over the contradictory things which would actually challenge someone who was more objective or not intellectually compartmentalized. So as Muslims, the strive to change the Muslim world and revive Islam is one of a political one, of political movements, it's a social movement. But unfortunately, it's not an unimpeded movement. We're facing resistance from these secular dictators that don't want things to change, and they're quite happy with the power structure as it is, which mostly favors them. And of course, those who are their backers behind them, who give them the weapons, the support, have a degree of interference in our internal affairs, which is United States and UK and so on, who support these regimes. And then they decry any movements which want to revive Islam. They call them pejoratively Islamists or Islamism or extremism or what have you, to denounce them, even though these movements are demonstrably much more fair. I'll just give you an example, right? So Mohammed al-Morsi in Egypt, he didn't even have any power. Some could say he was set up. Obviously, even on his presidency, the police wouldn't obey him. No one would obey. He didn't have any real power, though. But one of the things he tried to do, or he tried to say, was people could insult him and criticize him or say bad things against him, and he never called for people to be arrested or to be tortured or so on and so forth. There was this program by Bassem Youssef called Benemig, which is Egyptian Arabic for program, the program, modeling over John Stewart. He used to completely mock you know, Mohammed al-Morsi, right? So I used to mock him and so on. And then after Mohammed Morsi got kicked out of power by Sisi, who protected Egypt from the Islamists, Bernermeg was shut down, even though the guy is more of a liberal and liberal bent, or secular liberal bent, Bassem Youssef. It was shut down, banned. Anyone criticizing Sisi or saying anything about him is immediately incarcerated, locked up. Some of them are accused of being terrorists and subject to execution. You see, now this is under secular Sisi compared to a bit more Islamic Morsi. You'll see the difference. And yet Morsi is portrayed as the evil Islamist, and Sisi is portrayed as the hero secularist. You see, and this is the problem, that we are confirmation bias is that we will ignore the examples which disprove what we're being told in the media or the stereotypes, and we will only listen to the examples which reinforce those stereotypes. I mean, I'm no fan of Saudi Arabia. I'm one of their strongest critics, right? But there was a case in Saudi Arabia, and we all know of the quirky court cases that come out of Saudi Arabia. But there was a court case where a woman came to a court and said, my husband's abusing me, he's beating me up. And so the court judged that the husband will be sentenced to 30 lashes for domestic abuse against his wife. Was that covered in the news? Pin drop silence. Why? It doesn't reinforce the stereotype, which is common. So as to how we can change the perception of Islam, I think that is to we have to buy out Rupert Murdoch. But as to how we can change the Middle East, it's up to all of us to become to be reacquainted with Islam, become literate with both Islam's political philosophy, its theology, its legal theory, and strive to be advocates for this in our countries, despite the fact that obviously we face real threats from the government and more threats from those who back the government abroad. It is our issue. And at the end of the day, although we may blame United States, we blame dictators, ultimately the soldiers and the police who enforce the current status quo all come from our society. They come from us. And we have to be giving da'wah. We have to call da'wah means calling to inviting them to Islam. You know, because these dictators wouldn't be able to do what they did or do without soldiers willing to obey their orders or believing they are legitimate authorities. So as Muslims, and I pointed the Muslims here, it's your responsibility to go and spread the understanding of Islam and invite the soldiers, the police, and all those who have power to Islam. And then naturally, then the leader will be accounted. Some leaders might even change their mind because everyone around them is changing their mind. And they will be brought back to Islam, and we can establish justice in the Muslim world and be a good example, like we were in the past, when Western journalists or Western writers would go in the 18th century to the Muslim world and be so amazed about how liberated women were and how much justice there was for women. And they were shocked. And they said, there is nowhere else on this earth that the women are as happy or as free as they are in under the Ottoman Caliphate. You wouldn't even think anyone would say that now. So it's time for us to rediscover Islam, advocate it, and change our own situation, because it's not going to change itself. Okay, that's it.
Sorry to finish, we were a bit tight with time.